Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. My name is Mike Regan. I'm a senior editor at Bloomberg.
And I'm Aldana Hayek, a cross-asset reporter with Bloomberg.
And this week on the show, well, as you probably know by now, the stock market fell into a nasty bear market last year, with the S&P 500 dropping about 25% from its high in January to its low in October. But since then, that October low has actually held, and the index has gained more than 10%. That's led some to speculate that maybe the worst is over and we're actually at the beginning of a new bull market. Well, not so fast, says this week's guest. There's likely more pain ahead. And you'll probably want to listen to him because he happens to be one of the most well-known and experienced investors around, and he knows a thing or two about spotting bubbles. But first, let's talk stocks.
Yes, first, let's talk stocks with our guest who I know, especially terminal readers, they love to hear from him. They want to know what he's thinking. It's Jeremy Grantham. He's the co-founder and long-term investment strategist of GMO. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Pleasure.
We're really happy to have you. So you and I actually, just so readers are aware, you and I spoke a couple weeks ago. We talked about some of these things. And I was hoping you could maybe just start with you warning about a plunge in the stock market for 2023. How do your views align with what we've seen so far this year? And maybe lay out for our listeners what you're predicting for the remainder of the year.
Yeah, no, it's doing fine. It's behaving traditionally. My last paper was called After a Timeout, Back to the Meat Grinder.
Well, Vildana's a vegetarian, Jeremy. You got to watch it.
Yeah, I didn't
want to
hear that.
No, it's meant to sound painful and brutal. And the idea was that I personally am a great respecter of January as an unusual month. And what January does is it tends to be pretty kind to small cap and value. Indeed, more than 100% of all the small cap effect, so-called, has occurred in January for the last 100 years. So it's huge for small and value, but it also has this rather more complicated thing, and that is it does very well for stocks that got utterly hammered the year before. It's pretty obvious what happens. You lose 40, 50, 60, 70% or so. You take your losses to reap the tax loss effect. And then you have the money in your hand. And you have a year-end bonus, Christmas bonus, and so on. And you look out into the new year. You can see them as bargains. They're down a lot. In this case, the growth stocks. And so you buy them. So I was kind of fearful of that. The Grantham Foundation cut back its short position in NASDAQ. Didn't eliminate it, by the way. But it cut it back in honor of the January rally. And we look back at what happened in 2000. There are only a handful of great bubbles that look like this one. And the one that looks most like it is the great tech bubble of 2000. And during 2000, the blue chips continued to go up and they shot the dot-coms, and then they shot the junior growth stocks, and then the medium growth stocks, and finally, the great Ciscos of that era. And by the end of the year, the NASDAQ was down 40%. And a lot of the growth stocks, because the NASDAQ is a little more diversified, a lot of the growth stocks were probably down about an average of 50 or 60. It was a bloodbath. And that pretty much sums up what happened to highly speculative stocks last year, don't you think? I mean, they were taking all manner of grief. Cathie Wood's portfolio was down, I don't know, 60% or so. And so what happened in 2001? January 2001 was up 12%, led by the specs that had been wiped out the previous year. This seems, you know, so boring as to hardly be worth commenting on, but that is exactly what happened this year. And one of the proofs is if you take the order of horror last year and flip it, that is precisely the order of heroics this year. And I own one of these by accident 8 years ago. The biggest investment I ever made was in QuantumScape, the brilliant research enterprise doing solid-state battery work. But it doesn't have a product yet and won't for a couple of years and so on. So it was right at the top of the list. And it did utterly brilliantly in 2020. And it came out at 10 as a SPAC, four times my money. Yeah, not bad. Over 8 years, not great, but pretty good. And then it went to 131, $52 billion for a second bigger than General Motors or Samsung as a battery company. No sales or revenues for a few years to come. It had become a meme stock, but I was too close to it and too heavily involved to really see that. I understood the meme stocks. And I thought this was pretty impressive at 130, 52 times my money. And suddenly I had a holding that was worth $625 million, far and away the biggest. I mean, by more than 10 times the biggest holding I ever had, probably 25 times the biggest. And then it started to decline. And it was the first one to decline. Why not? That's how the great bubbles start, by the way. They don't start with Coca-Cola. They start with the craziest, most advanced stock. And that was QuantumScape. It started down in December 2020. Early in 2021, the meme stocks joined it, and Cathie Wood's portfolio got into step, and they all started to go down. Everyone said, well, it's a great bull market. The S&P was going up. But anyone who owned growth stocks knew differently. And they went down handsomely. And then into 2022, they continued to go down. And by December 2022, QuantumScape was 5.1. Now, this is a pretty good trick. Comes at 10, goes to 131, and it's now 5.1 in December of last year. So what did it do in January? Yeah, it led the way, went up 120%. not bad for 4 or 5, 6 weeks. And then right behind it, Cathie Wood's portfolio, I don't know, up 40%. And then the meme stocks, 30, 40, 50%, 60% rallies all the way down the line. It was perfect. It was almost too good to be true. It was eerie in its orderliness. Anyway, that's what happens. And it didn't stop the decline in 2001. They had a brilliant 12% January. The year was down 20%. The NASDAQ, which had been down 40% in 2000, went down 20% the following year and 30% in 2002. That is what happens in the great bubbles. They have wonderful rallies. They can have spectacular January rallies because they have more tax loss selling than any other situation. And this has been following the lead of 2000 perfectly.
Jeremy, I wonder, first of all, if I heard those sirens coming, I thought the Bulls had sent some police to pick Jeremy up there for a minute. I don't know where they're going. But you're still here.
I didn't even hear them.
I think they're on
streets
our side.
Of New York.
But, well, that parallel to the dot-com bubble, do you think, will that go from peak all the way to trough? Because, you know, I don't have a chart in front of me, but I believe the bottom wasn't until 2003, right? So, you know.
No, the bottom was in late 2002.
2002. Okay. But that would still mean we've got, you know, quite a long, you know, the forget about the Y axis, that X axis is got quite a bit of runway left till the bottom. Is that how you're thinking about it?
Yeah. Mostly the great bubbles, when they break, they take a long time. There's an exception, but they typically take a couple of years, 3 years. And every now and then they get rid of it in a real hurry. But my guess was this was going to be a long one. The buy-in to the idea that stocks only go up and the amount of speculative craziness that was set in train by the COVID supplemental payments meant that individual participation was actually off the scale, bigger than 2000, bigger than the dot-com. And so this looked like it would have a whole lot of buy the dip from day one, and it's had a lot of buy the dip, but 2000 had some wonderful rallies, and even in 1929 it rallied almost 45% off the lows of 29 until April of 1930. A hell of a rally. Must have made people feel that the worst was over, and then it rolled over and went down, as you know, infinitely, almost down well over 80% on the S&P, and most of the speculative index went down 95, give or take. Anyway, let's hope we don't go there. But it just gives you an idea. Great bear markets can have wonderful rallies. Great bear markets can take their time. And we have a very, very recent one where quite a few players in today's market experienced 2000. And it went on for three painful years. And the housing bust, you know, was a quick one, but not that quick. You know, it took over a year of pretty steady declines. So my guess is this one will not bottom until deep into next year.
Wow. So three straight years of losses, do you think?
I do think. I think there is a fighting chance that this year will not be down that much. And a very good chance, as I said in my letter, that through April, it might easily be up.
And that's the presidential cycle, right? Yeah. Talk to us about that. I don't think many people quite appreciate that signal.
No, you don't. You don't have many professionals talking about presidential cycles. It sounds too simple. It doesn't sound like something you could charge a good fee for. the January effects and the January rally ditto. These are considered far too simple to talk about. And it's probably why they work so well. Our first account at GMO 45 years ago involved both the January effect and the presidential cycle. It had worked for 45 years before that, and it's worked for the 45 years of GMO's career. And we typically have not used it, however, for the same reason that no one else does. But it's been a pet of mine forever. The presidential cycle is about as simple and straightforward and as understandable as anything in the stock market. What it says is that administrations like to be reelected and they like to help their party. So they worked out eventually, what is it that appeals to the electorate? It's the state of the labor market in the six-month run-up to the election. Anything that happens before that is forgotten. You can be brilliant for the first 2 years, terrible for year three, and you're toast. It really doesn't matter. It's the run-up to the election for 6 months. Now, the economy, as we've all discovered over and over again, is a kind of lagging instrument. You kick it, and it takes a year or so before it says ouch. So you better start stimulating quite a bit before the 6 months running up to the election. You want to get the labor market improving. You want to start when the presidential cycle effect starts, which is October, approximately October the 1st of the second year, last October, through April of this year, that window of 8 months, 7 months, is what it takes, because that gives you a little over a year to have it grind through and then start pushing up on the labor market. And would you believe that that's exactly what happens? Since 1932, this is not yesterday, since 1932, those 7 months have equaled the remaining 41 months of the presidential cycle. Don't believe me? Check it.
Wow.
It'll take you a while, but it's worth it. Those 7 months, therefore, have seven times the monthly power of the rest of the cycle. Seven times.
Wow.
So what is happening this time? Would you believe, since October the 1st, market's up decently. My guess, through April, it will stay up. I know the unexpected bears that Morgan Stanley and so on are talking about a fairly immediate decline. And that may occur, but my guess is it's hard to get this market really down until we get rid of April. And as the old saying goes, sell in May and go away and don't come back till Labor Day. This is the old kind of 1920s saying, goes back into the midst of time about the stock market. And this is part of the reason it works, because in year three, it really, really works. And after April, you're on your own. It's a kind of normal market through the election. And then year one and two typically are tough years where a sensible administration recycles to keep the whole thing going again the next time. You take some pain when it doesn't matter politically in order to be able to stimulate when it does matter in year three. So that's what I think is going to happen. That's the timeout. Those two influences together created my point about the timeout. After a timeout, back to the meat grinder. Now, all of the original problems, rising rates, relatively slow-burning inflation, intractable inflation, it's always intractable, bearing down on the market. The war, of course, like many wars, doesn't easily go away either. So and COVID has a long reach. We have a lot of little bottleneck effects that are still echoing through the system, and it brings it up. Brings up another important theory of mine, and that is our next paper, which will be called "The Long Term Is Now," because we have been harping on long term problems sometimes for 15, 20 years. Like climate change, one day will bite you. It'll be a huge influence on your portfolio. The growth rate of the economy is slowing down steadily. It will eventually start to impact profit margins one day. We're running out of resources, whether you like it or not. We're going to have rolling series of shortages and bottlenecks in resources. And finally, we're running out of people, and we're running out of people even faster than I picked up 10 years ago. It seems to be accelerating. Now, if you run out of people, that means you run out of labor. It feels inflationary, doesn't it? If you run right. out of resources, you run out of cheap copper and you run out of cheap lithium, it feels inflationary. And if COVID is hanging around, it feels inflationary. If you're deglobalizing global trade, some of the reasons for doing that, security, are really very good reasons. But deglobalizing is an inefficient inflationary process. Anything that's inefficient tends to push up the prices compared to a world where if you were globalizing, you're outsourcing your jobs to the cheapest pool of money and the cheapest pool of workers in the world. When you're onsourcing, you're doing the reverse. Great for the workers, it's long overdue, but it's not great for profit margins and it's not great for inflation. So I think all of these long-term factors are beginning to bite. This will make this particular down leg more dangerous and perhaps worse than we anticipated, and perhaps make it go on for long.
countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
So before we get to more of those long-term factors that you were just talking about, when you and I spoke a couple of weeks ago, you said the range of problems we have right now is greater than it usually is. And obviously you have decades of experience. So is it those things that you were just talking about, the war in Ukraine and some of the supply chain issues that are still lingering? Is that what you're referencing, or what is it about the current times that's so different or difficult?
It's those two things coupled with global politics, the Cold War coming back, and the deglobalizing that we are embarking on. And compounding that is that running out of resources, running out of people, and climate change are all biting into that equation, interacting with it, making it worse. And in that sense, could not happen at a worse time. And all of this is occurring on the down leg of one of the great bubbles breaking. They have never been very good. 2000, by the way, was a very benevolent bubble in that sense. It didn't have a savage recession. It didn't have any wars. It didn't have any deglobalizing. It wasn't running out of anything. The NASDAQ went down 82%. The S&P went down 50%. There was a recession. There was a huge recession after 1929. There was a huge recession after the Nifty 50 run-up of 1972. And there was the biggest bubble of all time, by the way, is Japan, who did a dual bubble in land, real estate, and the stock market, in peaking in 1989. And what was that followed by? It was followed by 20 lost years. If you look at the 50 years in Japan before 1989, it was like paradise, one of the fastest growing countries on the planet, if not the fastest. And then you look at the 30 years since then, they have barely grown. That double-barreled bubble, and the land was the biggest bubble in history. It was worse than the tulip bubble. It was worse than the South Sea bubble. It was the biggest, most spectacular bubble of all time, and the land under the Empress Palace really did sell for more than California. I mean, it was valued at more than the entire state of California. It was crazy.
That's amazing.
It was more than 10 times downtown Manhattan in downtown Tokyo. And you pay a high price. And happily, this bubble is not as bad as that. But it has more ancillary negatives coming in. And the first phase of a bubble is pretty simple. You take out the pin for whatever reason. All you have to do is convince people that it's not paradise forever, which is what they believe at the top of the bubble. And so it goes down pretty fast, leg one, always has a terrific rally. And then it gets into the much more complicated phase three, which is the fundamentals. The fundamentals have been artificially inflated by crazy optimism and by a long, drawn-out, perfect economy. And all of that is turning against you. And the question is, how bad? Is it going to be mild, like 2000? Is it going to be tragic, like 1929? Is it going to be long and drawn out, like Japan? Is it going to be very painful indeed, like the housing bubble, that will need unprecedented bailout? It's bad news. You don't want to mess with bubbles. I hold it against the Federal Reserve, of course. They created an environment, pushed up the price of all assets, every asset on the planet. And then they step back as if it's nothing to do with them when these bubbles eventually break, as they have done in 2000 and the housing bubble of 2006, 2007. And oh my God, no one could have seen this coming. These events, they stick out of the database like Himalayan peaks out of a plane, guys. Do not kid yourself. You couldn't miss 1929. You couldn't miss 1972. You could not possibly miss 2000. 35 times earnings. Anyone knows that 35 times earnings is pretty high. The previous high in 1929 was 21 times. 35 is significantly higher than 21. In Japan, it actually got to 65 times earnings, of course. The biggest one in history.
Well, Jeremy, let me interrupt real quickly because you did mention the Fed policy and the role it played in creating this bubble. So just to bring that into the present tense, you know, this week, Jerome Powell testified before Congress. He was a little bit more hawkish than, you know, the markets had expected, or at least the market response to it suggests that he surprised markets with his hawkishness. You know, the thinking is now the Fed funds rate could get as high as 5.5-6%. Talk to us about what Powell is doing. Is he being aggressive enough, not aggressive enough? And will it work? You know, will we the Fed alone be able to normalize inflation or all those other things that you're talking about? Deglobalization, a lack of resources?
Of course not. No, they don't have that kind of power. Well, they can mess around with interest rates. They have hardly gotten anything right since Alan Greenspan first arrived. Paul Volcker knew what he was doing, but since then, it's been a long, continuous horror show. They've engaged in policies that drive up the prices of assets, other things being even, and create spectacular overpriced bubbles. They then break, because that's what bubbles have to do. They simply break of their own extreme overpricing. And we pay a very tough price. And then the Fed races to the rescue. Oh, dear. The wreckage of 2000. They came in and they prevented it, the S&P, from going down more than 50%, which it would have done. They, with moral hazard, lots of aggressive language, and reduction in rates, they managed to curtail that at 50%. They couldn't stop a recession. They didn't stop the NASDAQ going down 82%. They threw the kitchen sink at it. And then what happened to Bernanke? He's facing a housing bubble. He says, oh, U.S. housing has never declined. It never had. It has never had a bubble before. It didn't have to decline. It was famously diversified between California going up and Florida going down, et cetera, or vice versa. And then he said the U.S. housing market merely reflects a strong U.S. economy. The U.S. housing market has a long historical record. You could measure it. It was a three sigma event, which is the kind of event in a normal series that would occur every 100 years. And all his staff could see that. No one apparently plucked up the courage to tell him. So he could apparently believe that the housing market was unremarkable. The housing market back then was beautifully well-behaved in, as a bubble. It went up, and then it came down in a beautiful round trip, symmetrical, perfect, the best one I ever saw. So 3 years up, 3 years down, they sucked in an extra three or four people to owning houses, 3 or 4% of the public. It went from a normal 62% to 65 or 6, the first time in history. And then painfully for the marginal buyers, it went all the way back to 61, 62. The housing market went all the way back to trend and actually overcorrected, which is typical, for 2 or 3 years. That's a lot of pain. It was all their fault. And why would we believe that they know what they're doing? And then they stoked the fire again. And this time it's real estate. It went to a higher multiple of family income per house than the housing bubble in late last year. After the biggest year in history, 20% for last year, biggest move, including the housing bubble. Forestry, farming, fine art, you name it. Bonds, of course, legendary, the lowest rates in the history of economics. And the stock market, way back up. Why would they do this? It's always the same. They always break, and everyone says, oh, it's fine this time. It never has been. Everyone says there won't be a hard landing. It'll be a soft landing. None of the great psychological bubbles have ever had anything other than an ordinary recession or a savage recession. There are normal ones, and there are terrible ones. There are no soft landings. in my little universe of super bubbles that you can see statistically as easy as pie. So why don't more people see them? Because it's not good for business. The commercial understanding is you're always bullish and that maximizes your money. Why Morgan Stanley is so bearish this time and a little bit of Goldman Sachs and so on is actually perplexing me. It's as if someone hasn't read them chapter two of the banking, investing, commercial, maximizing your profits manual. It has gone missing.
It's bothering you that, you know, the contrarian view seems to be the consensus these days, right?
Yeah, it bothers me. I do know as a historian that once in a while, almost everybody gets things right. It doesn't last long, but it does happen from time to time, just enough to bamboozle contrarians. And I am certainly expecting that this is one of those relatively rare occasions when almost anyone with a brain is being pretty bearish. Because as they say, almost to a man, they say the current stock prices do not reflect the high probability of profits coming down. And that is part of the story. And they're not even looking at the long term as now. They are not looking at all those longer term factors that we were talking about before. They're not looking really at the long term problems with climate change and resource shortages, and above all, people shortages. This people thing, you know, it's massive. It's happening so fast.
Jeremy, can I ask you then when you foresee a U.S. recession? Because obviously a lot of the data that we've seen coming in has been very, very strong. And we're taping this podcast before the jobs number comes out for February. But a lot of people are expecting a really hot number once again.
Economics, complicated, lots of cross currents, lots of leads and lots of lags. And I have tried to avoid spending too much time over analyzing the short-term data. First of all, they change it two or three times. Secondly, it's never as important as you think. The things that really matter are the broad sweeps of events, the forming of the great bubbles, the breaking of the great bubbles, etc. The rising of inflation, the falling of inflation. Really, this ridiculous concentration on the nuances of the Federal Reserve, who never get anything right. Why would we believe and exaggerate every little nuance? The market roars up, the market roars down. It is all ridiculous, folks. It is really ridiculous. Try and concentrate on
that. You saying that makes me feel better about my everyday angst.
you've got confirmation.
I can why, chill a little.
Why to be anxious?
Well, you journalists have a terrible job.
You tell me.
You have to come up with a reason why the market goes up or down on a daily basis. which would, if you got it right, we'd have to burn you as a witch. I mean, that's utterly impossible.
Creative writing, you think? That's
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's filling up space, actually, because it isn't that creative. Every argument for why the market goes up has been used 400 times, and the same for going down.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Jeremy, I wanted to get back to that notion of climate change. I know you've been spending a lot of your time studying the issue, but I want to talk to you about it from the role of the investment industry. Obviously, there's been a big backlash against the notion of ESG, you know, investing through the lens of environmental, social, and governance issues. You know, some on the right wing really want to do away with that whole strategy of investing. How do you think about it? Is there a role for investing to actually mitigate climate change if it's done properly? Or is it, you know, a marketing gimmick for Wall Street to extract higher fees to make people feel good about the way they're spending their investment money?
Well, the bad news from my point of view is humans are not great at these things. We've been bred over millions of years, like every other organism, to be incredibly short-term and incredibly aggressive, to grow and multiply, period. And anything that gets in my way gets trampled on. And capitalism is very much kind of an extension of survival of the fittest. It's very much an extension of the natural process, and that's probably why it's worked pretty well. And capitalism does millions of things brilliantly well. I mean, balancing the complexities of supply and demand is beyond, well, maybe in a few years, artificial intelligence will be up to it, but that is why the central governments had such a hard time. It's infinitely complicated. The problem is capitalism does not do those things that aren't in its immediate self-interest. If it's long-term, get round to it in a couple of years. If it's the commons, if it's something that I'm not getting charged for and I'm inflicting my pollution on someone else, why would I stop doing that out of the goodness of my heart? You know, try and maximize your short-term gains is what runs capitalism, and it's what makes it efficient most of the time. It only does these few things badly. It does not deal with climate change. It cannot deal with climate change. It cannot act out of the goodness of its heart to forego profits in the interest of the collective grandchildren. It's pretty bizarre, actually, that the everything is career risk in life. You know, you're protecting your job, you're protecting your firm, you're protecting its image. Very few people can actually say what they really want to say, what is really simple and straightforward. We're all caught up in basically protecting something or other. And when it comes to climate change, we're really not interested in anything other than looking good. We want to, for the lowest possible price, be seen to be the most civic-minded. We are not going to give up anything out of altruism. We can't. Capitalists, in general, can't spell the word altruism or patience, by the way. They want quick response. They want profits. And climate change is not their cup of tea. However, thank heavens, along with being a short-term, aggressive, grow-while-you-can species, we are very creative, very inventive. And so we have a terrific record in dealing with new inventions, coming up with new solutions. If we make it through climate change, and I use the word if deliberately, there's a decent chance that this will be existential, that it will remove a reasonably stable global civilization before it's finished. But if we make it, it'll not be because we're altruistic and we see our civic duty. It's because it will be good for business. It's because the inventions of wind, solar, and storage are simply going to be much cheaper than burning fossil fuels. And we will gradually replace everything, and it will pay. We will have silent electric helicopters that are getting you there at one-third the running cost and half the maintenance cost, and so on and so forth. And the technology improvements are merciless. They grind ahead. And today's battery constraint will not last. And they will have twice the power-to-weight ratio, and with a little bit of luck based on the latest and greatest ideas, perhaps even four times the power-to-weight ratio. So we'll be able to fly perhaps even to Chicago before this is finished. And all transportation will be electrified. And we will have plenty of cheap green energy before this is over if we can just hold the global society together and withstand the shock to food and immigration of climate change and terrible weather and so on.
That's a big if, Jeremy. That's a big if, it sounds like.
Unfortunately, it is a big if, and there's nothing we can do about it. And we frame this issue as the race of our lives, that the bad news is getting worse at an accelerating rate. We're actually still putting up carbon dioxide particles at an accelerating rate, although it's just beginning to flatten out now. And the good news is that I think the technology is moving at an accelerating rate. No one 15 years ago thought the cost of wind, solar, and storage would be. It's lower than building a coal plant today, almost everywhere in the world. And in most places with decent wind or sun, you can build and operate wind and solar cheaper than you could operate a coal plant if you were given it, built and ready to go. In other words, the full total cost of building and running a solar plant is less than the day-to-day operating cost of digging the coal, shipping it, and burning it.
Wow.
It's remarkable.
That is amazing. Well, that sounds like a nice little teaser of your next note. So we look forward to that, and we'll have to have you back to discuss that when it comes out. Vildana, Jeremy there reminded me of a good Homer Simpson quote. You know, it's that beer is the cause of and solution to all of life's problems. And it sounds like capitalism is very similar, Jeremy. The cause of and solution to all of our problems, perhaps. But Jeremy, really, really great to hear your thoughts. I feel like we could go on for 2 or 3 hours. So I hope you do come back someday and unpack some of these issues further. But before we let you go, we've got to do our tradition, Vildana. I'm going to go first with the craziest thing I saw this week. It's from Stephen Balaban. And it's about a perpetual bearer bond. Now, I'll tell you what that is,
please.
Because your eyes are starting to fog up there. A perpetual bond is a bond that pays interest every year, but never actually repays the principal. A bearer bond is an old-fashioned bond where whoever owns the paper and presents it to the bond issuer gets that payment. So Yale University has a perpetual bearer bond issued by a Dutch agency that basically dug the canals in 1648, Jeremy, a perpetual bearer bond from the Dutch government.
Yale owns this bond.
Yale owns this bond. They are still collecting payments on this bond from 1648.
That's cool.
The bond was actually written on goatskin.
Oh.
But they filled up, you know, every time they pay the payment, they mark it on the bond. So they ran out of space. So there's a piece of paper now that the folks at Yale every few years take to the Dutch water agency and get their payment, clip their coupon, basically. So, Jeremy, I hate to tell you, but you're now a contestant on a game show we call The Price is Precise. And the question is, what do you think the interest rate on that 1648 Dutch bond pays to Yale? And if it helps, I'll tell you the current Dutch 10-year yield is about 3%.
That doesn't help at all.
I didn't think it would. But this was issued in 1648. To complicate things, they actually rescheduled it. They redid the yield on it shortly after it was issued. So it's not the original yield. It was changed. But you have to guess what. Four and a quarter?
Four and a quarter. Oh, okay. I'm glad you went first. I was going to say something higher, but I'll go with 3%.
3%?
Yeah.
You think I was tipping my hand there?
Yeah,
with
maybe.
The correct answer is 2.5%, but the original rate was 5%. So maybe Jeremy's looking at that chart.
So how much have they raked in over the years?
5%. So the story says a few years ago, one guy from Yale went and collected 12 years of interest on the bond. You know what his payment was?
$153.
Oh, no. So I don't know why it's worth the flight to go over there. But Jeremy, if I'm issuing a perpetual bond at 2.5, are you a buyer?
I don't think so. I'm an issuer.
You're in a chat. Yeah, that's smart. Smart. Right, right. All right.
That's a good one.
You like that one? I think that's the craziest thing I've seen all year, actually.
Yeah, you're set. You never have to come up with another one. I'll go next. This is a Bloomberg story. Newark, New Jersey signed a sister city that doesn't exist.
What?
As its sister city. I know, but it's not markets related, so I didn't go with it. The one I'm going with, and Jeremy actually brought up the, you know, in the future, maybe having silent helicopters driving you around for cheap. But we have a Bloomberg story that says Elon Musk is so busy, his private jet is taking 13-minute flights. And we lay out all of these different flights he's taken. I think it's over the last year. And just, it's so counter.
13-minute flights.
Yes.
From like, that's like the Kardashians do that, don't they? From one side of LA to
like
the other.
Yeah, a couple minutes, yeah. But it's so counter to his ethos or to his, you know, climate.
Yeah. Clean energy.
Goals, clean energy, yeah.
Clean energy, 13-minute flights.
And he has taken, out of all the billionaires, he takes the most number of flights.
Wow.
Now, if that was electric, if everything under 200 miles was electric, we probably wouldn't even bother to say that.
Yeah, because exactly.
Right.
It doesn't use, it only uses about twice the gasoline equivalent of a taxi ride.
Right.
And quite remarkable. Anyway, the thing is, if you value your time at 100 times average, then of course these things make a lot of sense.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
He's running five companies.
Right. He's going from Yahoo. I'm
Yahoo.
Having a senior moment. From Twitter headquarters to Tesla's plant
it's
in California.
Not 2001.
Anyway. It is, according to Jeremy, it's pretty close, though.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking.
Do I get to give you my weirdest little
tidbit?
Of
course you do. Yeah, you're next.
Okay. Well, we've spent a lot of time working this out, and we think that the parts per million in the atmosphere that have risen from 280 to a current 420 will peak at about 525, 550, and we have to get it back to 280. And that will mean the removal of 3 trillion tons of CO2 has to be removed one day, let's say over the next 100 years. And if we get it down to $50, which we will, $50 a ton, that is $150 trillion to remove the CO2 after we have gotten to carbon neutral, to zero carbon.
What are our chances?
That is equal to 1% of GDP globally, smoothed out over the next 100 years.
Wow. Well, if we get some goat skin and issue a perpetual bond at 2.5.
That's it. That would pay for it.
Maybe that's what we do.
It would take a lot of goats, though. We'd have to go into the goat breeding business.
And that would not be environmentally.
That would not be, right? Jeremy Grantham of GMO, what a absolute treat to hear your thoughts. And like I said, we could go on for hours, so I hope you do come back. It was really an honor and a privilege.
That was fun. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. Vildana Heyrich is at Vildana Heyrich. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Stacey Wong. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.